Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service. Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to Beer Me on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Jane. During my time in culinary school, I gained an appreciation for good beer and continued my studies in beer at grad school at NYU. Since then, I have been a beer director, beer bar general manager, and I get to continue to explore the beer world with all of you wonderful listeners. Every week, I will have a different guest on the show discussing different parts of the beer world, from brewers, importers, educators. This will allow us to explore the dynamic world of beer through different lenses. Whether you're new to beer or a seasoned professional, we will have something for you. So today, on this bit of a dreary Monday morning, I am joined in studio by Maureen Opre. She is a historian and lecturer from Baltimore.
Yes. Hi.
Hi, Maureen. Thank you for coming down to D.C.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So about a year ago, actually, your book came out February 19th, right? In 2018.
Yeah. Actually hit the shelves, I think, in March, but yeah.
Okay. So yeah, about a year ago, your book came out. So Maureen wrote a book called Beer in Maryland, A History of Breweries Since Colonial Times. And you took a deep dive into the history of brewing in the state of Maryland.
Yeah.
And so I kind of want to take a deep dive here for our listeners, because I am not well-versed in Maryland brewing history, and I imagine a lot of our listeners aren't either. So are you ready?
I am ready.
So let's start at the beginning. What did some of the first known brewers look like in Maryland?
So when you're thinking of the first brewers, actually, we're not even talking industrial brewers. We're mm-hmm. talking us. Women. Mm-hmm. It was our responsibility, just like we would take care of the hearth or the family or the kitchen garden, it was our responsibility to brew. That is what we did in the home. When we're looking at the colonies themselves, a lot of the colonists that have come over are used to the water being not necessarily safe to drink, mm-hmm. but beer is, because of the process that it goes through, the boiling and so forth. It's not contaminated, so that's what you drink throughout the day. So when you think about the role of the earliest brewers, those are women, because that is what we're drinking throughout the day. Now, granted, most of it's really low mm-hmm. in alcohol. There's a few exceptions. I've got a few recipes from the colonial era where literally they recommend aging it for several years, and it's going to come out at a pretty high ABV. Yeah. But that's the exception, not the rule. So most of it's around 2 or 3%.
And so you have seen some of these recipes. What was in them?
So one of the things that's brilliant about our colonists is they mm-hmm. were happy to adapt. It was really easy for them to adapt. So initially they were getting their hops and their malt directly from England. Mm-hmm. So what they started to figure out was, wait a minute, we can't get the hops, they're expensive, they're not accessible, we're going to switch it out, we're going to find a substitute. Now, we do have, you know, ubiquitous hops here, mm-hmm. especially things like Chinook grow in the area. So if they could find wild hops that they could use, they would. But often they'll just use something like shed spruce or birch, mm-hmm. because it still gives that kind of piney, citrusy note that you'd expect from the hops. For malt, when they figured out they could actually use grains here in the colony, mm-hmm. They would malt them themselves. And there's a ton of recipes for how to malt your barley or Indian corn or wheat or whatever you could find. So,
okay.
Yeah.
They got creative.
And very creative.
In the words of Tim Gunn, they made it work.
Yes.
So, as
you see businesses grow and the industrial age come in. This is when you start to see the rise of the industrial brewer.
Yeah.
And what does that look like?
So initially, everything's done by hand. Mm-hmm. When you do have the industrial brewery start, before we really get too much from the Industrial Revolution, it's all done by hand. Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of what the modern breweries are doing and you take a moment and say, wow, this is all automated. And it's still hard work, like cleaning out the mash tun, getting the spent grain out, or using the paddle, whatever you're doing. Most of it's done by technology. At the time, every single thing was done by hand. You had a thermometer, you had a hydrometer, mm-hmm. And you're going to have that at the end of the 18th century. So that's going to help a lot as far as consistency and figuring out, where you are and getting your temperatures right. But when we get the Industrial Revolution, things really start to change, and you start to see steam replace bit by bit of the brewing equipment, even if it's a little 6-horsepower engine just to grind the malt. Now you have consistency in that malt that's being ground. So okay. That makes it a lot easier. Brewers that did that, they could go from making maybe 500 or 1,000 barrels per year to 5,000 to 10,000 barrels per year in the early 19th century.
Oh my gosh.
It's amazing.
And what are the predominant styles that you're seeing during that time?
So porter became very popular. Mm-hmm. So there was a big push for porter. Mostly what we were drinking were ales and what you would just call beer. And there's always a question of what's the difference between an ale and a beer. There's a lot of argument over it, and it's not always been settled. There's a few attributions to a certain king of England, for mm-hmm. example, in the difference. But really, the ales, when you're thinking of beer versus ale at this point, the ales are going to be maltier. They're going to be a little bit heavier, a little lighter in alcohol. Beer is going to have a little more hop flavor, not as much malt. But we're not going to see lagers until after the 1840s. So everything before the 1840s in colonial America and in Maryland, mm-hmm. Beer, porter, ale. And then in the 1840s, that's when the lager yeast can come over. It can make the journey because it's okay. only viable for 30 days. And we couldn't cross the Atlantic in under 30 days to bring the lager yeast here. Mm-hmm. So by the 1840s, we are using the clipper ships. We're bringing the lager yeast over. And that's when that's going to begin in earnest. So after the 1840s, you're going to add this nice collection of Pilsner along with the lager, Pilsner more towards the end of the century. But you're also going to have Berliner Weiss and other beers that are very unique for segments of the population that not everybody mm-hmm. was excited about that at the time, so they expected their beer, their ale, their porter. But there were segments of the population, and you've got some fantastic brewers that are strictly making the what we would call today the sour beers. Mm-hmm. And they had a following.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and for, listeners who aren't too familiar, Berliner Weiss is a, more wheat-focused beer, but is soured with lactobacillus to make it a little, very tart. And what were, was there an influx of immigrants?
Yeah.
In Maryland?
It's huge. Even from, our earliest brewers, we're seeing immigrants, German predominantly, some mm-hmm. Irish, some English, but you've got a large majority of German until you get to the Great Hunger in Ireland, and then you're going to see a larger influx of the Irish coming in to escape the famine. And it's amazing what they do. It's not just, hey, I'm going to America and I'm going to see what I can do. I'm going to America, I'm going to work at a brewery. Often the brewery is run by German immigrants. They've paid their passage to come over. You work off that passage, you learn how it happens, how the brewing is slightly different in America, mm-hmm. and then you go open your own brewery down the street, and then you pay someone else's passage. So it was this kind of chain of brewers coming over, and sometimes it was coopers, mm-hmm. or in the case of one brewer in particular, the Gunther family that set up the Gunther Brewery in Baltimore, he was actually more known for sweetening the cellars. So before we had refrigeration, lagering, it would be underground. So mm-hmm. subterranean lagering cellars all over Baltimore, Cumberland, Frederick, so many cities. It's
incredible, just like an entire tunnel system. But because you're underground like that, there are also bacteria and other things that happen down there, and you want to make sure that the beer isn't compromised. So anything particularly foul is going to be picked up by the beer, especially when you think of open fermentation. Mm-hmm. So there were specialists that knew how to sweeten the lagering cellars to prevent the spoiling of the beer.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've got this whole chain of like immigration policy happening through brewers.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating.
It is, but it's also what they do when they get here. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's great. Let's make some beer. You make really good beer. I'm going to open another brewery. There's literally almost a brewery on every corner in Baltimore by the end of the 19th century. But they're building communities. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them is building the community. They're taking care of roads. One brewer up in the northern part of Baltimore, it's now Gay Street. It used to be called Bel Air. He would actually pay people to just clean up the street. And there were, you know, several breweries on the road, but he would pay people just to come make sure there was no trash on the road because they cared about their community. We have other brewers that were building parks, donating when some, you know, catastrophic event happened. They would donate beer, they would donate meat, bread, bad winters, mm-hmm. Making sure people were warm. And when we don't really have a banking system at the time, or, you know, everybody's familiar with FDIC, your money's protected. You didn't have that then, and it was hard sometimes to get a loan. You had brewers that were successful, would open banks just so they could loan money to people in their community so that they could build their own businesses. It is amazing what they've done. And then you add the charities, the orphanages, the hospitals. They didn't just come here and set up shop to make beer. Mm-hmm. They came here to build Maryland.
Wow. So, and for those of you just tuning in, I'm sitting down with Maureen Opre. She's a historian and lecturer, and she wrote a book about a year ago called Beer in Maryland, A History of Breweries Since Colonial Times, and we're kind of taking a deep dive into the brewing history of Maryland. So when we hit Prohibition,
yeah.
the sad times,
yeah.
1920 to 1933.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there we go. Still got that date down. How many do you have a number or rough estimate of how many breweries were in Maryland? I'm putting you a little on the spot here.
Yeah,
right now.
No, that's okay. Let me actually do a little microcosm.
Okay.
Just the city of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
84 breweries
before Prohibition.
Mm-hmm. And then at their peak.
At their peak, and then after Prohibition.
So after Prohibition, you're only going to get a handful.
Yeah.
And there's two things that go in that.
Mm-hmm.
One is, well, some of them, God bless them, they literally, a few of them thought, this Prohibition thing will never stick. We're going to keep paying our employees full-time, even though we're not making beer,
mm-hmm.
because we think it's going to be overturned in a year or two.
Yeah.
They went under, trying to keep the brewery open. Some did the near beer and so forth. Those that did the near beer successfully, the beer that you make full-strength beer, you boil it until there's no alcohol left. You can only imagine what that tastes like.
Mm-hmm.
but those were better positioned because they had the equipment in place and they were up to date. Breweries that actually switched to making things like
malt syrup
had a little bit harder time. But also, the switch, it's a very significant time frame because you go from not everybody, most people had a steam generator on premises to power their brewery
mm-hmm.
before Prohibition. After Prohibition, it's all coming from a central power station when you think of Pepco or BG&E or what have you. To upgrade that equipment to handle that and to be competitive, it's at least $500,000 per brewery.
Yeah.
People can't afford that. No. So you're only going to see a handful after. And there's a lot of stuff that went on. I think we would have had a few more breweries, but Prohibition was an exciting time in Maryland because we were a wet state.
Mm-hmm.
And our governor, Governor Ritchie, he did not want to, he didn't adhere to it. He actually ran for president and was, Franklin Roosevelt asked him to be on the ticket as his vice president. And he said, no, it's either all or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran on the repeal of Prohibition. So he never paid to have state-level Prohibition agents. So it all had to be done at the federal level. So we got away with a lot in Maryland. There, you know, some of the great things were parties at the breweries at night, like the Gunther Brewery. H.L. Mencken, the former Sun journalist, he used to go. It was incredible, the people that would be there. Politicians, local family members, you know, shop owners, all kinds of people would gather late at night. They weren't allowed to park their horse and buggy or a car if they had one anywhere near the brewery. They'd walk in and they'd drink beer. They'd have incredible feasts. They'd engage in dialogues about everything from literally, think of the 20s, they'd talk about birth control. They would talk about, end of World War One. They'd talk about the Versailles Treaty. They'd talk about absolutely nothing was off limits. And it really kind of opened things up and brought people together, even during the dark time of Prohibition.
All right. Well, we're going to take a little break, and I will be right back with Marina Pry on Beer Me on Full Service Radio.
The song you're listening to during the break is Bring a Little Love by Keto. If you're tuned in, you're listening to Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Beer Me on Full Service Radio, recording live at the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Jane. I'm joined in studio by Maureen Opray. She is a historian and lecturer out of Baltimore, and she has written a book, Beer in Maryland, A History of Breweries Since Colonial Times. We've taken a deep dive from colonial times, bringing us up to Prohibition. And I want to talk a little bit about we're talking about Prohibition. We're kind of in those dark times. You've got a lot of breweries struggling and then failing. What are some, there was a mention in your book about breweries kind of surviving through crime.
Well, yeah, just a little bit. When you think of, as I said before, it's a wet state. So if you did what you were supposed to do and you paid your excise taxes, Governor Ritchie didn't care that you were making real beer at all. Just pay what you're supposed to do. So literally, a lot of the breweries survived on making sure they were supplying real beer, not only for their patrons specifically, but for the many shops and taverns and restaurants. If you wanted, for example, real beer, you'd look for a sign outside a tavern that said fresh fish today, and that was the signal that they had real beer on tap. So as long as they're paying the tax, the cigar shop's the same thing. They would literally set up a cigar shop with cigars in glass cases, but they weren't really selling anything. You'd go in, you'd look at the manager and say, hey, Joe sent me, and then he'd let you into the back, and, you know, beer is flowing, the taps are flowing in the back. So, yeah, it's not exactly legal, but it's legal in the eyes of Governor Ritchie because you're paying your excise taxes, so he'll warn you when the federal agents are going to come raid. So, yeah, it was kind of a nice setup, actually.
So you obviously had to do a lot of research for this book. What were some methods that you used, and what were some really cool things you kind of found out along the way?
So the No Stone Unturned? So there was a book in 1964, I think is the year that it came out, a self-published book by a man named William J. Kelly. And he, some of the historical figures that are in the book were still alive at the time. So he kind of went on this journey to try to record the history. He did a really good job when you think of a time before internet and, you know, all of the things that we have today to allow our, you know, you can find out what the holdings are of a historical society now online before you drive all the way out there. In his case, he had to drive all the way out there and then discover if something was there or not. So he was the last person that actually tried to put the history together, and obviously it's the 60s, it's very outdated, but there was also a wealth of information that was not in the book. So for me, that was a good touchstone to see what had been done. But it's also literally every historical society. Library, Enoch Pratt Library was great, Maryland Historical Society, Maryland State Archives, literally going through everything, reading, you know, every newspaper I could get my hand on. I actually, one of the more interesting things for me was there are so many German immigrants that were brewers. There was quite a bit of German newspaper and documentation about the breweries that you couldn't find in English. So I ended up learning how to read the German so that I could translate the information and get it in the book. So that was not something that was
you
in my
taught background. Yourself German?
Yeah. And
bravo.
Now, don't ask me to speak it because I absolutely can't, but I could recognize it, read it, and, you know, a nice little dictionary to help me to make sure, you know, because some of that older German, the G's and so forth, look very similar to other letters. So
okay,
it was
yeah.
a bit of a
journey.
Yeah. But it was worth it. It okay. was worth it. And interviewing families.
I'm more intrigued about that, about interviewing these families and getting to hear some of these stories. Is that where you got a lot of the information that isn't typically published, you know, about these parties that you were talking about?
Yeah. So those were unpublished manuscripts. So the one about the parties at the Gunther Brewery, that was Michael Lardner and a friend who knew I was doing the research, that I've got an unpublished manuscript from someone in the family about their experiences and working at the brewery. And of course, I'm going to eat that up. That's fantastic. But also, one of the breweries coming out of Prohibition, the Globe Brewery, the Fitzgerald family, they remember Dad / Grandpa working at the Globe Brewery. He made the first beer out of after legalization in 1933. So they shared this incredible story of their family, not only of his work, and I think that's the thing, and you just are seizing upon it, and that's the thing for me that makes it so special. This isn't just here's dates, here's breweries, here's times, here's what they made, production value.
Yeah.
It's people. People make history, and when we forget the human element, you know, sometimes it's a family feud, sometimes it's, like in the case of Mr. Fitzgerald, it's literally he married his wife for life, and he would never remarry, and he raised all of their children, plus his sister's children after she died, by himself.
Wow.
While he worked at the brewery. I mean, it's just this compassion and devotion and that element that we often leave behind. It was so vibrant and so rich. And in some cases, the Bauerschmidt family is a perfect example. That line, of course, is still in Maryland. They were huge in Baltimore, but throughout the state, and they distributed down to Virginia and North Carolina and so forth. But when I was working on this to get in touch with and talk to the descendants, just like with the Fitzgerald family, it was fantastic. And I found out that James Bauerschmidt, he actually makes mead. He's a brilliant mead maker. And he had thought about going back into the family business, but the laws were a little too hard to try to like push through to make that happen. But he's a brilliant mead maker, so it's kind of carried on. And it was an honor for me to be able to share a piece of his family history that he didn't know, because I had gone through court records and I had found out this, you know, fascinating story about gold coins that he had never known.
Wow.
So the Bauerschmidt family was used to, they were poor from Nuremberg. So when George actually was successful, he bought $14,000 worth of gold coins and buried them in his front step. So after he died, they excavated the steps. There was only 4,000 in gold coins left. The big mystery, what happened to the other 10? So it became a court case. So it was good to be able to share that with the family. So to help them uncover some of their past that they didn't know existed.
That's amazing. So you taught yourself German and you basically became a more effective ancestry.com.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm kidding. So we are running a little bit out of time here, but we have time to talk about a really cool organization that you are a part of, and they do a lot of really great fundraising. And this is kind of, you know, touching on, again, the fact that brewers are community builders. And this is something we've talked about on the show multiple times, in that brewers do a lot for the communities that they are in. And we've seen that here in D.C. a lot. So you are part of the Baltimore Beer Babes.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not going to ask where the name came from. But so what did you all do this weekend?
So yesterday, Union Craft Brewing in Hamden was kind enough to host us for a calendar shoot. So the first...
A tasteful calendar shoot.
Very tasteful calendar shoot. And we started that last year. So the first calendar was the 2019 calendar. And it is women in the brewing community. So there's brewers, historian, owners, tap house owners, distributors, women that are in the industry all got together, and we do this calendar shoot, and all the proceeds go to the Kennedy Krieger Autism Institute.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, and I said this to you earlier, I am humbled by the people that are in this industry. I am thankful every single day of my life that I am in this industry, even if it's an ancillary way by recording the history, because I have met some of the greatest people in my life through this industry because they give back. They care so much about the community, and they do everything they possibly can. So this is huge. We raised thousands last year, and that was the first, you know, kickoff of it. Yeah. And this year, there was quite a large turnout for the shoot, and... we're thinking that we can at least double what we did last year. So the calendars will end up being on sale probably the end of August, beginning of September at Mahaffey's Pub in Baltimore. Alice Kistner, who owns Mahaffey's, she's a brand new owner, brand new proprietor of Mahaffey's. She's been there for years, but finally purchased it. This was her baby. This calendar is near and dear to her heart. And I couldn't be happier to be a part of it. So please look for it.
Look for it. Donate to the cause. It's a great cause. And also, I've said this many, many times on the show, especially when Kevin came down from Union.
I love Kevin.
You know, Baltimore is so easy for everyone to get to in D.C. It's an easy train ride. It's an easy drive. Well, sometimes an easy drive.
Not today,
but otherwise pretty easy drive. And it is so much fun. There's so many things to explore, especially beer-wise. So definitely go check it out.
And all the breweries in between.
Yes, all the breweries in between. Well, thank you so much for coming to the show. I'm fascinated by all this information. So
Thanks for having me. It's really great.
This has been Beer Me on Full Service Radio. I am your host, Sarah Jane. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can reach us on Instagram at Beer Me Radio, also on Gmail at beermeradio@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week. Cheers.